love that song, "I Will Build My Life Upon Your Love." I didn't talk to Addison about this, but the Lord planned that because that's what we're talking about a little bit today, building. And I've learned, as a dad of four boys, that there was a necessary prerequisite to being a dad of four boys, and that is having a black belt in Lego construction. I can't tell you how many Lego structures that we have built. And if you've ever built anything with Legos, you know that success is achieved when you've worked piece by piece, using all the right pieces and all the right places and all the right ways at all the right times, and you're building this model that matches the box. And if you're doing that model that matches the box, going freestyle is never a good idea. And I mention that because life is a lot like a Lego building project. Our lives are made up of all sorts of different pieces, people and events and circumstances and times and places, and they're all being locked together to make our individual stories. Often it seems like there's this brick missing and it's hard to keep going. And sometimes we don't see the significance of a certain piece of our story until much later on. Or sometimes there's tremendous joy and satisfaction as a particular piece just locks into place and crowns it and just brings it all together. But there's a big difference between real life and Lego construction. And that's this. We are not the ones with the instruction blueprint in front of us. God is. But we have individual pieces, and God has given us enough explanation to start building through the Bible and through His Holy Spirit, but only He has the master plan. Only He has the blueprints. And we are building our lives. We have an idea of how we want to do it and how we hope it's going to turn out. But there's so much in our lives that we just cannot control. And so that raises the question that we're considering today. How can we live in a world and in our lives that are out of our own control in so many ways? How can I construct my life when only God has the master blueprint? How can I navigate all these complexities of life, of joy and sadness and loss and sorrow and pain, without knowing or controlling what's happening next? As we continue our series through Ecclesiastes, Living Life Backwards, we're going to look at a famous passage in the Bible that Bart just read. It's been the subject of songs, "Churn, Churn, Churn" by the Birds quotes this passage almost verbatim. This passage has been used at countless funerals. It's even non-Christian funerals sometimes will use this passage. And the reason for this passage's fame is because of the poem at the beginning of the passage. And it's a poem that we can all relate to. It brings together the big picture of our lives. And then, afterwards, it explains why our lack of control might actually be a reason for us to have hope. And so today we're going to see three main points. We'll first see one main point from the poem itself, and then we'll unpack that a little bit, and then we'll see two more points as we look on later in the chapter about that applies that poem to our lives. So we'll see a total of 3 points today. And pull out your note sheet and your bulletin if you haven't, and open with me, if you're not already there, to Ecclesiastes 3. The first thing we're going to see is this. Though it's out of our control, God orders everything in our lives at just the right time. And as you write that down, we're going to begin reading this poem on our times. So let's read in chapter 3, verse 1 once more. "For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. This poem speaks to the rhythm and timeliness of our lives, which, though we don't always admit it, is almost completely out of our control. Just as the created world has certain rhythms of seasons built into it, so our lives and our experience as humans have their own regularities and cadences that ebb and flow with the rolling of the years. We dance at a wedding, and then we mourn the loss of the one we danced with. We laugh together with a friend, and then we weep for the ways that the person that we was our friend has hurt us. You know, we check our calendars every day, but we don't set the seasons of life just by the months and the years. Instead, it's marked by maybe becoming a daughter and a sister, and then becoming a wife and a lover, becoming a mother and a grandmother, and becoming a widow. Those are the seasons that God gives us. And in this list of seasons and opposites, there's actually 28 items in 14 pairs. And so it's multiples of seven all the way through. And as we know in the Bible, the number seven is the number of completeness, number of perfection. And so this is a complete summary of the seasons of our lives. And it puts flesh on the skeleton of our human lives. And I'll tell you, this poem, it really does that. As I looked back this past week and was meditating on these verses, I could not help but thinking about moments in my life that marked different seasons. I thought back to the first time my wife told me that she loved me, 3 months after I told her I loved her. I thought back to our first kiss. I thought back to my first drive home from the hospital with my newborn son. I remember joking around with my little sister around the sink because she was using two sinks to get ready in the morning, and I just wanted to use a part of one for a moment. And I remembered a few short days later walking through a cemetery with my parents to pick out her grave. There's a time to be born and a time to die, a time to weep and a time to laugh. And it's all in the hands of a God who does things at just the right time. And Solomon says, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a dandelion, there's a purpose for your birth, for your death, and everything in between. The time will come to weep. One day you'll get a call that maybe one of your parents has died. And it'll be a time to weep, and it'll be good to weep in that season. You shouldn't try to be happy. But the pain won't last forever. There'll come another time when maybe you get a promotion or you purchase your dream home, and you'll laugh. Solomon says that life is going to be like this, and there will be absolutely nothing you can do about it. You'll have children and you'll laugh, and then one day you'll have children and you'll cry. Maybe one day you'll have children and you'll yell. That's the way it is. There are times of happiness and times of pain, and you don't die from something unexpected. If you don't die from something unexpected, then there'll come a day when you get some diagnosis and you'll weep. And all these things are ordained. We can't know what the days will bring. There'll be a time that you destroy something but by throwing stones, but also a time that you gather stones to build something. There'll be a time for you to embrace. And there'll be times when you just don't want to embrace, a time to refrain. There'll come a time that you'll be full of hope and you'll want to search. And there'll be a time when you'll be hopeless and you'll want to give up. There'll be a time when the things you own will be useful and you'll keep them. And then there'll come a time when the thing that you used to think was so useful and special to you will go away to Goodwill and be given to somebody else. There'll be a time when joy fills your heart and your home, and there'll be dancing in your kitchen. And there'll also be a time of agony when you'll hurt so bad that you'll feel like you want to tear your clothes and your soul has been shattered. And then there'll be a time that you want to sew those clothes back up because your soul's being put back together piece by piece. There'll be times when you want to keep your mouth shut and times when you just want to tell somebody something and you can't wait. There's a time to love and a time of rejection. And all those things are appointed. There is this rhythm and time to everything in our lives. And though we don't always like it, God's timing is always just right. See, we want things often to happen on our clock, on our schedule. But the truth is that God's clock is the one that keeps ticking along. And whether we like it or not, it keeps ticking. Right on schedule, though we can't predict it. And at the outset here, the author gives us the two most stunning examples of this, our birth and our death. No one gets to pick the day of their birth, do they? You can't choose to be born in the summertime. You can't choose when you're born. You can't pick the day of your death either. There was a guy named Vicomte de Turenne who was mortally wounded in battle, and he said, "I did not mean to be killed today." Job 14:5 says, "Since his days are determined and the number of his months is with you, and you have appointed his limits that he cannot pass." Psalm 139:16 says, "In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them." The initiation, the duration, and termination of our lives is under God's control. He's the King of time. He regulates our minutes and our seconds. He regulates our moments and our days. And nothing happens without his sovereign superintendence. From the flutter of a butterfly's wings to the fall of a civilization, God's in control of it all. And there's an orderliness and a precision to God's control. We may not have a blueprint, but nevertheless, he makes sure that every Lego of our lives fits exactly into place where it should be, even as we disagree with his placements. Ecclesiastes 3:1, "For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven." And then in verse 9, the poem ends with this question: "What gain has the worker from his toil?" It's a return to this question that's been asked again and again in 1:3 and 2:11. How can I have gain or profit in my life if my times are all set and ordered by God? And what we read, what we just read, is that you and I are living in a story that somebody else is writing. And if I'm a character in a story that someone else is writing, how can I have lasting success and hope and gain? Well, there's two things in the following verses that help answer this and should fill us with hope. And the first is this: God's timing is wise. God's timing is wise. Read with me in verse 10 to see this. "I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time." It says he has made everything beautiful in its time. So God's plan is not haphazard. He doesn't improvise. It's not like he's just seeing chaos and responding to it. It's not like God created man and then Satan tempted him. So God kicked man out of the garden and then Satan caused him to corrupt civilization. And then God countered with a flood and so on. No, God's plan is like a Beethoven sonata. It's orchestrated. It's creating something beautiful. And every note contributes to the overarching melody of God's plan. And you know, sometimes we look at this world, we look at our lives, and we think, "God, no, you think this is wise. But are you sure this is the way to go? Seems like it would be a lot wiser to go this way. Seems like, man, why would we do it this way, God? Why would you let me go through that? Why won't you just take the pain away? Why won't you just do this my way?" But we need to come to grips with something that is really important for us to understand. And that is this: we are in a poor position to assess the wisdom of God's plan. In the book of Job, there comes a point where Job has been questioning the Lord about why he would allow the evil in his life to befall him. And God answers Job, and it says this in Job 38. It says, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Who is this that darkens counsel by my words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you will make it known for me.'" God says to Job, dress for action like a man. He's basically saying, put on a cup, Job. It's big boy time. It's about to get real here. And then he continues. Verse 4, he says, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what mark were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" This questioning of Job then continues for three chapters, which must have felt like an eternity to Job. And God is saying to Job, you need some perspective on how big I am and how small your understanding is. God's point is that he alone is transcendent, and he alone sees the end of history from the beginning. And sometimes we may think something is poorly timed or, man, it just was an unnecessary evil, but we are so limited in our perspective. God may have permitted something to happen for a reason that we couldn't even begin to fathom. You know, there's this developing field in science called chaos theory, and this is where scientists have discovered that certain large systems, like weather systems or insect populations, can react to the tiniest of changes. And so they talk about how a butterfly fluttering its wings in West Africa could set in motion forces that eventually cause a hurricane over the Atlantic. But it would be impossible for anybody seeing that butterfly flapping its wings to see the effect that it would have caused. But God sees it all. So the brutal murder of an innocent man or a child dying of leukemia could send this ripple effect through history that we might not see God's reason for it for centuries. And yet God sees the end from the beginning. Our God is so incredibly wise that he sovereignly works all things together at just the right time to accomplish his purposes. And God has wise reasons for what's going on in your life at this moment right now. There's a story told in Mideastern folklore of a man who lost his horse. His horse ran away. And when the horse ran away, his neighbor came to him and said, that's bad luck. Your horse is gone. And the man said, what do I know of these things? And a few days later, the horse came back with 20 other wild horses with it. And his neighbor came to him and said, amazing, it isn't bad luck, it's good luck. You've got 20 more. And the man said, what do I know of these things? And his son was taming one of the new horses, and that horse kicked him and broke his leg. And the neighbor came to him and said, terrible, isn't it? Your son's leg is broken. Man, that's bad luck. These horses came. The man said, man, what do I know about this? A few days later, a bunch of thugs came by looking to recruit all the young men, able-bodied young men, for their gang. And they were going to pick out his young son, but then they found out his leg was broken. And so they didn't pick him, and they moved on to the next house. And the neighbor says, good luck, isn't it? Your son broke his leg. In one little series of episodes, we don't know what lies ahead. And so when you're tempted to ask God why he would let things go this way, maybe you should wait for the day that you are going to stand face to face with him. And you'll find out that there were reasons you couldn't understand. And there was a beauty and a grandeur to God's magnificent timing that you had no comprehension of. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Now, not only do we see here that God's timing is wise, but we also see that it's mysterious. It's mysterious. God's timing is mysterious. Look with me again at verse 11 to see this. It says, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, He has put eternity into man's heart, yet so he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. So in the second half of verse 11, it describes this tension in our existence. It says God has put eternity into our hearts. There's this sense we have that there should be real meaning and lasting order in life. We have this innate sense and hope that this life is not all there is. We have this longing for something more glorious, something eternal. And we intrinsically know that there should be order and purpose and justice in life because God has put eternity into our hearts. But at the same time, there's another side to this coin. It says he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. So we have this sense of eternity in our hearts, but in this life, we can't discern how that works itself out. We try to recognize God's purposes, but we can't figure it out. And so we ask questions. Why would you do this, God? Why is it this way? Why not this way? Why would you take my friend? We squint, but we can't see. We see dimly. We see in part. He's put eternity in our hearts, but he doesn't give us all the answers. And that's troublesome, isn't it? Because we want to know why God let this happen. We want to be able to say, oh, that's why it happened. But God sometimes says, sorry, I'm not going to tell you. And God isn't being unkind to us by not sharing that. You see, we aren't built to understand the big picture. If we could see the end from the beginning and understand how a billion lives and 1,000 generations of unspeakable sorrows and untold joys are woven together into a tapestry of perfect beauty, then guess who we'd be? We'd be God. And we're not God. So we are in a position where we have to trust a wise and mysterious God. And God is so much bigger than we often think of him. He's not a genie. He doesn't cooperate with us the way we want him to. He doesn't behave. It's like Aslan said in the Chronicles of Narnia, he's not a tame lion. And it's important for us to realize that because it'll cause us to trust him and worship him. You know, many people would prefer a transactional God, a God that says, you live like this, you'll get this. They prefer a God they could manipulate and control. But if you have a God you can control, a God who is not mysterious, then guess what? You don't have a real God. The true God isn't neat and tidy like we'd like him to be. In Deuteronomy 32:39, it says, see now that I am he, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand. You see, part of being wise in this world is learning to accept our limited framework of the big picture. We want access to it. We're hardwired to want access because we have eternity in our hearts. But the point is that we cannot figure out what God has done from beginning to the end. And that means that part of learning to grow wise in this world is learning to grow small. God intends us to be like children who trust their parents because they know that their parents can see what's best even when they can't see it ahead. And that relationship of trust is built on the character of the parents. If the parents are good and wise and kind, then they'll trust you even when they don't understand. And the same is true of God. And so I can trust the God who is both wise and mysterious, even though there's times in my life that don't make sense right now. God's timing is perfect. You know, sometimes we get a glimpse of why God did something, but other times, often, you're just a nail and you're being hammered. And you look at the hammer and it's merciless and relentless and it's just crushing you again and again, and you cry out in desperation, why does this hammer continue? But you need to remember something. You need to remember that both the hammer and the nail are servants of the master workman who is building something bigger and more beautiful than you could imagine. And once you remember that, you can trust the wisdom of the master workman, and your fear subsides and you fall into place. You trust the strikes of the hammer are working together all things for good for those who love God, as Romans 8:28 says. But as nails, we need to surrender to the will of the workman. A.W. Tozer said, "It's doubtful whether God can bless a man greatly until he has hurt him deeply." You know, at the end of Job questioning, God questioning Job, we read Job's response to the Lord. And let me show you what it says. He says in Job 42, "I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. I had heard of you by hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." Job had come to surrender to a God who is both wise and mysterious, and so must we. But now the question arises, if I surrender to a God who is wise and mysterious, how should we live? How should we build our lives? And what Solomon tells us is that we should enjoy the building process instead of fretting about tomorrow's missing pieces. So our next point is this: we must refuse to let what we cannot know destroy what we can enjoy. That's kind of a confusing sentence. Let me say it again. We must refuse to let what we cannot know destroy what we can enjoy. And look how it says this in verse 12. It says in verse 12, "I perceived that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live, and also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man." Now, I regularly meet with Christians who are upset because they are not God. They want to control things in their lives that are utterly impossible for them to control, and they are tormented by their own helplessness. But the truth is, you can't be God and control your circumstances. And there's nothing you can do about that. So what should we do? Well, Solomon says, don't let that negate your present enjoyment of life. He says, don't get cynical, don't get unhappy and worrisome. Instead, do good. And in this short life, trust God, do good, and enjoy what he's given to you. This past summer, I had the privilege of officiating my little sister's wedding. And their story is a beautiful story of God's redemption. And how many of you have been to a wedding that is just blazing hot? I've been to a wedding that's blazing hot. I was born in August in Palm Desert, so I know a little bit about blazing hot weddings. But this wedding gave a new definition to blazing hot. And it was hot, it was humid, there was no breeze, and I was in a suit in the middle of the sun with just sweat dripping down my face. And after the ceremony, I drank some water quickly to keep from passing out and took a couple pictures and then got in the air-conditioned car and drove over to the reception. And the reception was at this beautiful home with this gorgeous infinity pool, and it was outdoors with all these tables around the pool. And it was just beautiful. And everyone was thinking the same thing. That water looks so refreshing. But everyone was dressed up. I mean, there's like 200 people there. And everybody's very formal, wearing tuxes and stuff. My sister's wearing like a $2,000 wedding dress. And no one dared to get close to the water. Until my wife jumped in, pushing my dad in with her. Her in a formal dress and him in a full suit. So she is far more adventurous than I am. And before long, the entire wedding party, the bride, the groom, and everyone attending the wedding had jumped into the pool in their formal attire. And it was probably the most memorable wedding I've ever been to, except my own, sweetie. So I think part of what this passage is saying is this: jump in the pool. Enjoy life. So my natural inclination is to worry, oh, if I do that, I'm going to be soggy, and my suit might get messed up. I don't have a towel and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But this passage is telling us stop being anxious and worrying about tomorrow so you can jump in and enjoy life today as a God-given gift. Jesus put it this way. He says in Matthew 6:34, "Therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble." So jump in the pool. Enjoy the good gifts that God has given you. Listen, every one of us is going to die. The clock is ticking. Someday a doctor may look up from his chart and tell me he's found something in me that shouldn't be there, and I'll have surgery and be poisoned with cancer treatment, and it's going to be pretty miserable. But today, I'm okay. And so you can either sit around worrying about tomorrow, or you can enjoy the life God has given you today. So right now, while everything's okay, go get a bowl of ice cream of Rocky Road. Go out with a friend who needs some encouragement and enjoy their company. Hang out with some good buddies and enjoy some conversation. Throw a frisbee around with your son or your grandson. Date your wife. Romance your husband. Show the people around you that you value them. So I'll go on a date with my wife on Friday, and we'll go get some Italian food and maybe afterwards have some cheesecake and coffee, and it's going to be great. And I know there's a day coming that a car is going to veer into me, or my body is going to wear out, or I'm going to be diagnosed with something, but I refuse to let what I can't control destroy what I can enjoy today. That's Solomon's counsel. Enjoy the building process, even if you don't have the blueprint. Now, this chapter ends with one final truth. One day, this building process will come to an end. And so we must trust the only one who builds that which lasts forever. So our final point is this. Because we are mortal, we must joyfully entrust our lives to the immortal judge. Now listen to how this passage describes God's permanence and judgment, beginning in verse 14. Solomon says, "I perceived that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. Moreover, I saw that under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. And so I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them that they may see that they themselves are but beasts." Now, what's going to happen is Solomon is going to describe our mortality from a human perspective, beginning in verse 19. Let me continue reading there. It says, "For what happens to the children of men and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so the other dies. So dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to the dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of a man goes upward or the spirit of a beast goes into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better for a man than he should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. For who can bring him to see what will be after him?" So Solomon says, from a human perspective, humans are no different from animals. They both just return to the dust, and that's the end. But before that, he says that perspective is not entirely true. You see in verse 17 there again? It says, "I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked." The preacher here, Solomon, says, this is the truth that you need to carry with yourself. The times in your life are not the only times that there will be. There is a time to be born and a time to die, and there will be a time of judgment. And one of the ways that we learn to live by preparing to die is realizing that judgment is coming, and that's a good thing. Because that gives my present actions meaning and weight. It gives my experienced losses and injustices God's voice in eternity. What's past may be past, but what's past is not forgotten to God, because He is in charge and He lives forever. Every single thing that happens will have its day in court. And so this passage finishes by contrasting our finite stories with the story. And in this finite story that I'm living, there's broken characters and unexplained difficulties and jarring interruptions and contradictions and unanswered questions. But my life, my story, is not the story. And the story reveals that there will be a time of judgment, and believers trust that that will happen through God's Son, through Jesus. You see, in the story, the culmination of the story was the perfect timing of God sending His Son into this world. In Galatians 4:4, it says, "But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons." Jesus is the one person who came at just the right time and was completely obedient and righteous. And what did He get for that? He was tortured and nailed to a cross where He would die of suffocation. And what good could possibly come out of an evil like that? Well, God turned that most evil thing that ever happened into our salvation. And today we can celebrate that Jesus' suffering and death was the best thing that ever happened, because He triumphed over the grave and over sin. And for 3 days it didn't make sense, but then on the third day it did make sense. And He was delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. It says in Romans 5:6, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. And so though we are mortal, we live in time with all sorts of limitations, that mortality should drive us to the only one who is immortal, who conquered sin and death, rising in victory forevermore, and giving us hope with Him forever. Amen? Let me close with one final thought. Right now, you may feel as though there are pieces in your life just are not making sense. Nothing is fitting together. The build isn't going the way you wanted it to. And that's okay. You're not in charge of the blueprint. But no matter what you're going through right now, you haven't faced anything like Jesus faced on Calvary, have you? And the purpose of that evil was so that you and I could be secure in heaven. And if God can take evil like that and turn it into good, then can He take the evil things in your life and turn them into good? Yeah, He can. And is He going to explain it all to you? Nope. But can you trust Him anyway? You can. So trust God with your times. Enjoy the time you have now. Enjoy the people God's given you now. And do good. Don't waste your time. And know that your life is being built by the only one who builds things that last forever. Let's pray.